session number 4808 reel 2.
Mr. Golding, reel 2.
The one thing, when we were sunk, of course, we lost our beautiful Beaufort, which we'd never fired in anger anyway. So we were gunless now, so they decided to turn us into infantry. And therefore they gave us, I suppose it must have been about a week's infantry training, which meant absolutely nothing, since our instructors knew nothing about infantry work anyway. But infantry work in this particular area just meant firing a gun. They did give us, I suppose, a rather primitive form of they called them Sten guns then, sort of like a Tommy gun type thing. Certainly we thought of ourselves as playing gangsters anyway with them at the time. And they sent us on various pretend patrols, which was quite useful because, in fact, again, the Japanese did land in Java early in March, and they did make some incursions into, these rubber, I think it was a wild rubber plantations. They turned into forests after a time after they left. And I remember one of the most vivid memories, much more vivid, in fact, than any of the actual POW experiences, was taking a patrol one night through one of these rubber plantations and hearing voices in English coming saying, "We see you, Johnny." Now, fortunately, that was one of the good things that we were told. And that was that they really can't see you, because if they could see you, they'd shoot you. But you think they must be able to see you, because one of the curious things is that the only thing that lives up to one's, film-type inspiration of what the Far East looks like is the moon. The moon really is bright, and it really does give you the impression that you can read by it. And it seemed, one felt very naked indeed, but the rule was stand absolutely stock still, because though they can't see you, they can hear you. And you slide away afterwards. But so, in fact, it was a very nerve-wracking experience, but it wasn't quite as dangerous as it sounded, provided you kept your head. What they really want you to do is to fire your gun roughly there, direction, so they can then see the flame, so they get a good aiming target. But I can't remember if it had a special name, the Batavian airport, they took that, and then we retreated to a place called Bandung, which is in the hills, which is almost the equivalent of Pune to India.
Kind of hill station.
It is, yes, where a very, very pretty town. Sort of place I always thought at the time I'd like to go and visit again in peacetime. It's, because Batavia is one of the hottest places around. It's actually below sea level, if anything. And in the hot period, everybody goes to the mountains for the holidays, so it is a hill station. And there were some Dutch barracks there, but we never came into contact again. March the 8th was the surrender. We were told on March the 7th we were going to fight to the last man, but on March the 8th, I can always remember, it was quite pathetic in its way and quite sweet in its way. So our commanding officer handed everybody a large bar of Cadbury's Dairy Milk chocolate, and that was the end. We were then, but there was a period of time from then, which probably was a week. It would be stupid of me to try and get any closer than that, when we didn't actually see any Japanese.
What happened during that week?
Well, it was actually, in my case, I was very unwell. I got caught tonsillitis up there because of getting soaked and all the rest of it, and we had no shelter at all. We just, As a matter of fact, I think I worked out once that from the moment we left Malay and went down to Singapore and onwards, I doubt if I slept in the same place two nights running, and very rarely with any shelter. So I was pretty low ebb, and they finished up, and somewhere out there I was had to spend the night when we were going to fight to the last man, slept the night out in the open when it was pouring with rain the whole time, and I went down with a touch of tonsillitis. So when the Japanese, in fact, did come, I was taken to hospital. I was already in a hospital in Bandung, which were nearly all either wounded or people who were ill. So that was, in a sense, was quite good. Though it was, in a sense, it was bad because I missed all my own unit who were taken elsewhere. So I spent the rest of the war, or at least 90% of it, with strangers in terms of groups. Which in one sense was quite lucky because the headquarters, a lot of the regiment were all killed on sunk by an American sub on the way to Japan, and a lot of my own particular unit were killed by the atom bomb in Nagasaki. So I probably was very fortunate. I'll tell you, incidentally, that this is from a psychological point of view, which is, I don't know if it's interesting or not, that from having, the moment I was sunk at sea and picked up safe, I never doubted I was going to survive from then on. I believe that to be quite important because I had all the normal illnesses which everybody else did and which awful lot of people died from, because most of them, like beriberi and the malnutrition diseases, there was a lot of, if you knew, it was a question of giving up. You know, people gave up and said, what the hell, and just turned over and died. And others didn't. And I had I never sort of doubted for a second that I was going to survive. So I think that was of some importance. Anyway, I was discharged with a whole group of people, we were sent to a place of, well, we used to call it Landsop. I think it's short for Landsop Voedingsgesticht, which is the Dutch word for a state reformatory in Bandung. And since I was released from Changi jail, I went from starting the reformatory and worked my way up to the biggest prison in the East. It was both good and bad from a prison point of view. It was good in the sense that it was properly built. It was a structured place. And there was water, though not enough, obviously. There were proper latrines, not enough. But on the other hand, it wasn't makeshift, and there was shelter when it rained. The problem with it was, of course, that it was much too crowded. It was, I don't know how many boys it took, but it certainly didn't, there were hundreds and hundreds of us. I don't know how many there were, but it seemed as if we were very crowded. They did quite a bit of propaganda on us there, incidentally. When we marched in, we had to march in several times with newsreel photographers taking us, and we were expected to be singing and cheering.
Did people cooperate with that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I think we sang in 10 more months and 11 more days we're going to turn this loose or something. And also there were some words used which I don't know if the Japanese understood. They did later on, mind you, our cards, but they didn't at the time. So, yeah, we cooperated. We had, incidentally, got lots and lots of threats. one I can still remember very vividly because it was the first one. We had a chap in charge of us at this stage and throughout Java, I might say. I don't know if you've heard his name before, Colonel Dunlop, who was an Australian doctor surgeon. He was actually a superb man. I think he was a very good doctor, actually, but he was a marvellous leader of men. And he's the only man who really, at times, made the Japanese, I think, were a little frightened of him, because he did things which I'm sure anybody else would have been killed doing.
Why was he so admirable?
Well, first of all, he looked the part. He was very tall. He was a good mover. He had a fine presence. And he appeared, he gave the outward appearance of not giving a damn for anything. I mean, one knew he was being a surgeon, and he knew he was a gentleman and understood things. So therefore he wasn't one of these absolutely mad-headed people who one doesn't really respect. He wasn't sort of an Errol Flynn type, but he was quite clear that if he thought something was right, he would say to him, you know, shoot me then. And really, you know, one felt he had our interests at heart. And this was the other thing, because, let's face it, there wasn't the split, as far as I know, certainly not where I was anywhere, between officers and other ranks that there were in Germany, for instance. So,
how do you mean there wasn't a split?
Well, we were the same camp. And this meant that there were plenty of officers, for instance, who kept their heads down when they should be out there taking some of the flak. But he was never like that. He was very much to the fore. Certainly, I've never heard a word spoken against him. I've heard a word plenty said about most of the others. And anyway, to get back to Lansop, now he was going to have evening roll call, and they had a like patio effect, nearly all these camps were, and he was standing among the, almost like a proscenium in a theatre with lights coming down. And then the Japanese commandant came on, and at that time, well, from all time afterwards, all commands were given in Japanese. This was about one of the first things we had to learn, were Japanese military commands and also numbering. Now, he misunderstood something. He was told to stand to attention, and he misunderstood that early on and thought that was to mean dismiss. And he dismissed us when we should have been standing to attention. The man went berserk and started really beating him up very, very hard indeed. In fact, drew his sword, first time I'd ever seen one draw his sword, and thought he was going to kill him there and then. Now, that I think from that moment on, we realised life was going to be fairly rough. That was the first time we'd ever seen any of the rumours that we'd heard about actually taking place. And so that was a fairly good lesson learned. So there was a fair amount of cooperation, though in fairness, I don't think that we were ever expected to cooperate in a way which would make very much difference to the war effort anyway. I mean, we were very much on the sideshow, very peripheral what was going on there, and I wouldn't have said that anything we did really was of very great importance to the war one way or the other.
In this camp, what were the rations like for you?
Well, the rations, right from the word go, were always bad. There was no camp that I was ever in which anybody ever had enough to eat. So I wouldn't say that. I can't remember exactly what we had there, but But they're near enough the same wherever we went, which was that of papped rice.
Like a cupful.
It was a cupful of papped rice for breakfast. A cupful of fried rice. Not fried, boiled but separate rice, you know, steamed rice for lunch, which, and then with lunch there'd be a certain amount of soup with it, but no meat or anything of that sort. It was a vegetable soup, which apparently was a weed which grew around there, which must have been the most marvellous weed in the world, because all the doctors, there are a lot of doctors in our particular group, because we, you know, as I say, we're in the hospital, and the hospital moved with us, all maintained quite firmly that we weren't getting enough protein to live. We should all have been dead. But, and the only thing they could suggest was that this particular vegetable, which, well, I don't think it had a name, actually.
It wasn't called Kang Kong, was it?
Yeah, it could well have been, though we called it Green Death at the time, because it was very, very green. Must have had a lot more protein in it than we thought. So it was very powerful stuff.
Green death because it was so horrible.
So horrible, yeah. But on the other hand, well, it didn't get horrible after time. And then in the evening, the same again as lunch. That was my... I suppose I'm jumping ahead now, but my overall impression is hunger. And curious enough, I've never been able to replicate that since a while. And I've been ill, and I've had quite a few malarial relapses, or I think doctors call it paramalarial. It's not really malaria, it's simply if I get flu, I get the shivers and like malaria. And so that brings back the memory. Sometimes I can get frightened, a tune or something, or a particular smell or something like that can bring back some of the fear of what was going on. But I've never been able to replicate the hunger, because the hunger, you know, if you go without food for a bit, being hungry is rather pleasant, because you know there's something that you can fill up with. But at the end of the day, at your last meal, when you know there's no more food to be had, and you're still starving hungry, it's very, very depressing. And at the after time, it almost becomes a way of life. So that when you moved camp or anything on afterwards, you'd ask people who were there, what sort of camp is it? That meant, was the commandant fiddling the rations, or were you getting a full amount? Because they nearly all did. But don't blame them, because I don't think they're very well paid, but they would get so many rations and sell it to the locals.
You said that Dunlop got that beating, yeah, because of the misunderstanding.
Yeah.
But could you say more about how the Japanese treated you at Lanzhou camp?
Well, it certainly wasn't the worst. I mean, we thought it was horrific, but compared with some of the things later on, it was very, very small stuff. One of the things that happened there, which was interesting, because in a sense it was depressing, I suppose, that was the place where we all had our hairs shaved off. Now, in fact, told afterwards, it's probably a good thing, because it saved lice getting up there and all the rest of it. But somehow or the other, it made everybody feel non-existent. It's astonishing how much everybody looked alike with the hair shaven off, and it was a very depressing experience that we somehow or the other felt that we'd lost our individuality and that we really were prisoners then. I think that was really what Lanzhou meant to me more than anything else. We didn't have any particularly hard work to do there. The hard work started, I don't think we were there all that long actually, but the hard work started when we were moved into a bigger camp in Bandung, which was an old, again, as a camp was very good, because it was a Dutch army barracks. I don't remember exactly what it, the name of it, but I think that's unimportant. But there we did quite a lot of work. The rations there, if anything, were worse, because the rice we got was so bad. The quality of rice was so old. In fact, it was, somebody said it was rather good for us because it was practically all maggots. We were advised officially by our doctors and to read while we were eating so that we shouldn't see what we were eating, because lots of people put off, and of course you know, it was absolutely a death trap if you didn't eat. The one of our main jobs actually was carrying these sacks, because there were lots of dumps knocking around, and this led to some quite amusing things, which...
These were sacks of rice, were they?
Rice, yeah. The Japanese theory was one sack, one man, but since there were a lot of good trade unionists with us, we always worked out two sacks, two men for one sack, and they used to led to lots of beatings, but we'd reached a stage now, maybe... I'll talk maybe a little bit deeper on this later on the sociology of prisoners, that it was worthwhile to get beaten to do something like this, which is, seems absolutely absurd, but it was a little triumph which was necessary, and we won our point after a time. So, example of a strike which works.
So it was better to resist than to give in, you mean?
Well, yes, in this particular instance. Though we had quite a joke about this, because we had a lot of Dutch on this camp, and one of the interesting things that came from a sociological point of view, that there was far more hatred between the Dutch and the English than there was between either the Dutch and the Japs or the English and the Japs. The Dutch being very colonial Dutch. In other words, they were nearly all of them people who lived in Java, and they were the Saabs of India or the Tuans of Malay, and they weren't really soldiers. They were really, it was only because they had national service, and that as soon as there was any trouble, they were called up as reservists. So they weren't really fighting troops. And our feeling towards them was that, you know, they'd had it so good before. What the hell were we doing there anyway? And they felt that we should have defended them better. So there was no love lost. But there were some young, strong ones. And during our quarrel with the Japanese about one sack, one person, some of the Dutchmen were, to show off, picked up two sacks and carried it, to which the Japanese said, "There you are, you know, they're strong, you're weak." And we said, "Yes, we're terribly weak." And it took quite a time for the Dutch to realise they'd carried the whole lot and we hadn't done a thing other than applaud. But that was, again, was another minor triumph that didn't last very long.
Apart from instances like that, how did the tension between British and Dutch manifest itself? Were there ever any fist fights or anything like that?
Oh, yes, but not... I mean, over the period of three... Well, they were Dutch wherever we were. Over a period of whatever it was, 3.5 years, I suppose they're half a dozen times, no more. They just, you know... As time went on, there was less energy for fisticuffs anyway, and there was more energy for shouting or screaming and so on.
Were the Japanese able to exploit this difference between British and Dutch?
No, I don't think so anyway. No, I don't think so.
Whilst you were in the camp at Bandung, did you have any contact with or receive any help from the civilian population outside the camp?
No, there wasn't an awful lot of civilian population. There were only women, and they got interned. There was, I suppose, about a year later, there was, we used to, we, our job, our main job was making sacks for rice out of sisal, or at least we spun the sisal. One of the things I still know how to do if you have no sisal, I haven't got a machine, but sisal is a plant, it's rather like a piece of string. If you have a piece of string, you can undo it, you know. And you see those different strands. Well, we were making the strands. We were unraveling them with very, very old type of machine. I mean, it was very much, I imagine, the sort of thing that Cartwright and Co. There was one man pulling handles, and I think there were four bobbins on each side going like this, and you fed them in little twists and that. So it was very much like a spinning, in fact. It wasn't weaving, it was spinning. Now, if you... the Japanese used to examine these very carefully. The reason here was that they used to have little rackets on selling this stuff. So they wanted good quality, and it came in various qualities, and your bobbins got marked, so that if you... I can't remember exactly what the 1, 2, 3, 4 A, B, and C, but it wouldn't have been A, B, and C, it had been 1, 2, 3, and 4. And if you were very good, you got an outing once, well, you get one. I don't think anybody ever got more than one. And I got an outing once. That was about 20 or 30 of you, with a guard, obviously, and a sergeant. Take you for a walk through the town, which was quite pleasant in itself. But then he took us round where the women's quarters were, and then if he was in a good mood, as he was the time I was, the women were allowed to throw things at us, bits of jam, and bread, and so on, things that we'd never seen. And then we could take them, and he'd march us back. And give us a little speech to the effect that how wonderful the Japanese are and the spirit of Bushido and all the rest of it, dismiss. So that was, there were, I'm talking of the sergeants, there were two very interesting characters actually. The two main sergeants at Bandung, one was Hock and Hosh. Hosh was Hoshino. I forget what the Hock was, Hock. Probably Hokkaido. They were both real regular old sweats, and rather like sergeant major, except, of course, in the Japanese army, a sergeant to that rank has the power of life and death over everybody junior to him. But it'd be like a, you know, literally power of life and death. And he'd... they're like an English sergeant majors, but much more powerful, and they could be absolute swine, these two. They really put the fear of God in us. But on the other hand, in a curious sort of way, they could be quite fair. They were, you know, by this stage, it was rather odd that those who were going to adapt had started to adapt. And therefore, for instance, a very serious rule, because they had odd rules about smoking, because the Japanese are the smokiest race in the world, or were then. And they were, so your rules about smoking were very strict. And one of them was you couldn't smoke outside. Not too sure why. I thought that was safer outside than inside. But anyway, you're not allowed to smoke outside. And so that it became a matter of pride to smoke outside and conceal it. But if you were caught, you got very badly beaten. But we'd reached a stage by then, I'm talking about, when you didn't think that was unjust or unfair. You felt that way, fair cop, as it were. So you adapted, in fact, to this was the social order. And... one felt with both Hosh and Hock that on the whole they were they were just, if you accept that code of conduct.